Hi.
Hello.
So, what I'm going to talk about with you guys today is opportunistic infections and treatment of them. We're only going to do a few of them, not all opportunistic infections, but we'll do a few. And hopefully this is review for most of you, and we're just reinforcing. But feel free to ask questions as we go along. So, one of the things actually that's not on here is, when do you start treating it for HIV, and when do you start treating for opportunistic infections? And there was actually a large study done about 2 years ago trying to figure that out, that the timing, because you can imagine who has opportunistic infections. What kind of CD4 counts do people have when you see an opportunistic infection? Anybody want to guess? It's usually less than 200, right? It's rare that someone has an opportunistic infection with a CD4 count greater than 200. So the mortality associated with low CD4 count, less than 200, is very high. And so there's always this tension of, you know, do I treat the OI and then start heart? What's the concern, I guess, everybody has about treating opportunistic infections and also treating HIV at the same time? I hear it all the time when I'm on the ACS or IRIS, right? Everybody's always worried that you're going to have this immune reconstitution, this vigorous immune response in the course of treating opportunistic infections. So about 2-3 years ago, there was a large clinical trial to look at this in terms of timing. And what they saw was that if you treat, and most of the patients that are actually, it's a hard study to enroll. You have to have pretty sick patients, and you have to decide this group's going to get treatment for both at the same time, this group's going to get treatment for the OI, and then later on we're going to start their antiretrovirals. And what they found is that most of the patients that were studied ended up having PCP, two-thirds of them, that delaying antiretroviral therapy was worse outcome than actually treating them together. And they didn't see a tremendous amount more of IRIS if you treated both simultaneously. However, you know, I think there's still a lot of caution that has to be thought of if someone has a lesion of their head. So if they have cryptococcal meningitis or toxoplasma encephalitis or CMV retinitis, most of the docs would say, in those cases, I would treat the OI first, and once the person's probably a month or two into treatment for the OI, then start the antiretrovirals. Okay, so just keep that in mind. So let's start off with PCP. Now, PCP, now it goes by the name of pneumocystis carinii jirovecii. It used to be, you know, pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, we would commonly call it. So 90% of the cases are with CD4 counts less than 200. Other risk factors are CD4 cell percentage less than 14%. Previous episodes of PCP, of course, because you're already immunocompromised. Oral thrush, recurrent bacterial pneumonia, unintentional weight loss, high plasma viral load. These are all the things that are associated with PCP. These are all things associated with AIDS. Mortality is 20 to 40% with profound immunosuppression. PCP for AIDS patients is still one of the larger causes of death. Clinical manifestations, subacute, progressive dyspnea, fever, non-productive cough, and chest discomfort. I would say one of the things that's classic of PCP versus other kinds of pneumonia that AIDS patients present with is a prolonged process, 2, 3, 4 weeks, gradually worsening, more shortness of breath, gradually with weight loss, but not profound fever. You'll see feverish, 100, 101, but you're not seeing what you see with maybe tuberculosis, where 103 fever. You're not seeing usually a real thick mucoid cough. It's usually scant phlegm that just continues to go, and the patient's dwindling over time. The chest clears, maybe have rails. Oxygenation, they say variable, but one of the things to know about PCP is, if you're concerned about PCP, what is one of the things that you want to do when the patient presents? What's one of the tests that we always, or two tests, I say, that we always are asking for? O2 sat, right? So you want to know, either do an ABG, you want to do an O2 sat, you want the patient to exercise and see if they desaturate. And why is that important?
Steroids,
right? It's going to be critical whether or not we start steroids if they have an AA gradient. And usually, you know, it might be a little bit of variation depending, but an AA gradient of more than 30 to 40 is where you want to start steroids. And that's because there's a profound improvement in mortality if you start steroids with a larger AA gradient than if you didn't. So if you just start Bactrim, or you know, if the patient can't tolerate Bactrim equivalent, and they have a larger AA gradient, you're not going to have a great outcome. You need to start both if there's a larger AA gradient. So how do we figure out the AA gradient?
Calculator?
No, not calculator.
You want to know the formula? Oh, 760 minus...
But simplify it. So we're at sea level.
Okay, minus the pressure of water, which is 47.
Yeah, yeah.
Multiplied
by 4. So that's 150. It comes out to 150.
Yeah. Minus the PCO2 divided by the respiratory coefficient, which is 0.8. That's the alveolar pressure. You have to raise the alveolar... the arterial pressure that you have to make.
Everybody understands? So if I tell you someone came in and their PO2 was 60 and their PCO2 was, we'll say 40, what's their AA gradient? Who wants to jump in? 100? Okay, we got 150. So 150 minus PO2, let's say, is 60. So that gets us down to 90. And then PCO2 is 40 divided by 0.8. So that comes out to 50. So 50 plus 60 is 110. So 150 minus 110 is 40. Okay? Does that make sense? So its AA gradient is simplified for sea level, 150 minus the PO2 plus the... So, in parentheses, so 150 minus parentheses PO2 plus the PCO2 divided by 0.8. Now we'll give you the AA grade. And that's important because that's one of the more important things, you know, for care of patients with PCP, because again, steroids will save lives. LDH. So this is the second test that, you know, in addition to chest x-ray, so we can say three tests. So LDH is something that we always want to look at too. And high LDH, greater than 500, because PCP is this diffuse lung injury, is consistent with, but not necessarily diagnostic of PCP. On the other hand, a low LDH, like less than 200, rarely will that patient actually have PCP. So that's how the LDH can help you. So, you know, I would say it's an adjunct to your AA gradient, to your, you know, seeing if the patient desaturates, adjunct to your chest x-ray, adjunct to your history, but it's something that if you were to order another test in there trying to piece together whether it's bacterial pneumonia, TB, or PCP, that's where the LDH can help you.
What other opportunistic infections can produce elevated LDH?
So, like any kind of diffuse lung injury, so TB, bacterial pneumonia, yeah.
Histoplasma,
TB? Yeah. Yeah, here's a part, so they can all do it. Chest x-ray, right? Typical thing we see is bilateral interstitial infiltrates. It's a diffuse injury. We used to see some atypical presentations when people were getting pentamidine treatments, but we don't use much pentamidine anymore. So it's, you know, most of the cases of PCP that we see actually are people that are not on prophylaxis or are actually newly diagnosed and present to the, you know, emergency room with PCP pneumonia, and then we're doing HIV testing. Atypical presentation, you can see nodules and blebs and cysts, asymmetric disease, upper lobe localization. And that's more, again, with pentamidine therapy, we see more of the upper lobe localization. That's because they used to do this once a month, inhaled pentamidine, and the pentamidine would settle into the lower lobes. And so when you did get PCP in those patients, it was more in the upper lobes. Pneumothorax in a patient with HIV infection should raise the suspicion of PCP. I mean, definitely. You've got to think that it's a bleb that actually has burst and they've developed it. Cavitation, intrathoracic adenopathy, pleural effusions are common. About 13 to 18% of patients with documented PCP have another concurrent cause of pulmonary dysfunction, like TB or bacterial pneumonia or KS. Now, we don't see too much KS these days, but... So here's sort of a classic presentation of PCP. It's diffuse injury. You get that sort of ground glass, alveolar picture going on. With a real severe case, you can see it's everywhere. It's not localized. This is afterwards. You see a huge cyst here, right? So how do we diagnose it? You guys know this. We don't do too many bronchs anymore, but when I was training, that used to be the thing. You'd have a patient come in with PCP, and you'd bronch them, and then you would do their lavage, Now, mostly it's expectorate sputum, so we'll do the induced sputums. And depending on the lab, NARS is probably, I would say, pretty good. Is that maybe about 70 to 80% of the sputums are positive in a patient that ends up having actually proven PCP, meaning about 20 to 30% are negative, and then you're actually going on your clinical impression of whether or not you're going to continue treatment. Because we always have this tension when we admit the patient. Are we going to treat them for, what are we going to treat them for? Is it bacterial pneumonia? Is it PCP? Is it TB? You'll see we'll isolate a lot of patients and we're trying to tease it out. So induced sputum comes back PCP, we're able to actually narrow the diagnosis, of course. This is what a Gimsa stain looks like. GMS over here, silver staining. Okay, one of the things that we're looking for is you can't culture the organism, so we're looking actually at coughed up organisms stained here in terms of this. There's really not resistance to trimethoprim sulfur that we can pick up clinically. If you go to a research lab, sometimes you'll see papers out there that say, oh, there's some pneumocystis actually resistant, but you also find out that pneumocystis responded to trimethoprim sulfur. So when we talk about treatment, the treatment is still going to be trimethoprim sulfur as our treatment of choice. Sometimes even you find patients actually present and they tell you, oh, I have an allergy for trimethoprim sulfur. It's the best treatment if we can desensitize them, we try to. And you know, I'm convinced that some of the allergies we have actually are more with the tablet form than the IV form, because people sometimes tolerate, they'll tell you they have this allergy, and maybe it's one of the incipients in the tablet, but they tolerate actually IV form. And it's still by far and away the best treatment is trimethoprim sulfur. We'll talk a little bit about prophylaxis coming up, but there's some tricks you can do for patients that have sulfur allergy in terms of desensitization. Again, you know, it depends which paper you read, but usually if you say an AA gradient of 30 or more and give them steroids, or PO2 less than 70, that's usually important. And the sooner the better. You know, you don't want to actually have the patient on the wards 3-4 days and then be starting steroids, because that's a patient who's going to get into trouble. You see reduced mortality of 50%, rescue steroids after 72 hours of uncertain benefit. And if the patient's really sick, you may have to do ventilatory support. So this is what I started off with, is how do you time ARVs with PCP treatment. Now the latest study that came out, ACTG would argue that actually you should treat them together pretty soon, that probably within 2 weeks that patient should be on ARVs. There's some improved survival for those patients versus delaying ARV therapy more than 2 weeks. So, what do you do if a patient doesn't respond? So in the absence of corticosteroid therapy, early reversible deterioration within the first 3 to 5 days of the therapy is typical. But there could be lack of drug efficacy in about 10% of the cases. You're in trouble. If you have a patient who's on trimethoprim sulfur and is not responding, I can tell you you're in trouble. And I can't say then switching to pentamidine is going to be much of an improvement. That, you know, trimethoprim sulfur is your drug of choice for moderate to severe PCP, even for mild PCP. So there isn't really a rescue therapy to go to. And they recommend here parental pentamidine or primaquine combined with Clinda for moderate to severe disease. Those are definitely alternative therapies. Those are not primary therapies. Treatment-limiting toxicity. So, of course, with trimethoprim sulfur, the big problem is rash. And you can even get a Stevens-Johnson. And I'm not sure anybody's ever here seen Stevens-Johnson from a medication, but I've seen him to sulfur, and it's, you know, horrendous. Fever, leukopenia, thrombocytopenia, azotemia, hepatitis, and hyperkalemia. So these are the ones that usually we'll see on the wards. We'll have somebody being treated trimethoprim sulfur. We'll see hyperkalemia, hepatitis, rash, sometimes fever. So you got to keep those all in mind. Leukopenia, all these things are pretty common with trimethoprim sulfur. So those are the treatment-limiting toxicities. Pentamidine, I should probably blank this out before you guys read it. But so around. What's the problem with pentamidine without looking at the slide? Anybody here use pentamidine for any patients that have PCP? So what made you use pentamidine? So he had azotemias. So that and the last thing said limited.
And then I had patients before
Right. So that's the problem with pentamidine. So usually, yeah, after about 3, 4, 5 days on pentamidine, people start showing toxicities to pentamidine. And so the common things are pancreatitis, hypokalemia, hypotension. So these are all the things. And then it becomes rate limiting. You really are unable to really continue pentamidine at that point. So you can see hyperglycemia, electrolyte abnormalities, hypotension. Then you're starting to talk about, well, what do I do next? So then it's dapsone and primaquine. Of course, dapsone, you got to worry about hemolytic anemia. So usually you want to do a G6PD before giving anybody dapsone. So I know this is hard to read, but it's just summarizes actually preferred, alternative, and other options for patients with PCP therapy. But it's exactly what we said. These are the regimens for trimethoprim sulfa. These are the regimens for pentamidine, and then alternatively primaquine and clindamycin. And then you can see actually here it gives you the steroid tapers. Right. So when do we use Mepron? Anybody want to jump in? So prophylaxis, but also for treatment. And it's the same exact dose. The thing for treatment, though, is usually for folks that have mild to moderate. So someone that's got a big AA gradient may not be the treatment choice. But on the other hand, if you have a patient who you're able to get through 5-6 days between trimethoprim sulfa and pentamidine, maybe you can switch them over. Yeah. Maybe then you're stuck and you can go to etoveqon. Etoveqon, you know, occasionally see a rash, but it's relatively well tolerated. So that's what's the beauty of etoveqon.
So whenever we see a bump in the creatinine of that, then that's always
exactly. Right. Right, exactly. Primary prophylaxis. So trimethoprim sulfa again is the key to actually PCP treatment and prophylaxis. Now there's I'm not sure if anybody has, but you probably, when you're over on ACS, you see there's this yellow book from Johns Hopkins. They change the color every year. It's like a little Washington manual almost for HIV. But there it gives you actually desensitization protocols. And they're very effective. So for patients that you want to give trimethoprim sulfa to, who you're concerned about, so patients that you're worried about sulfur ration, which is almost everybody who gets trimethoprim sulfa, it's about, you know, you can go back, but about 30 to 40% of people exposed to trimethoprim sulfa have some level of reaction to it. Anything from just mild symptoms to a little bit of rash to actually where they have to discontinue the drug because of major allergy. But if you desensitize them, you get much better tolerance. And so there's desensitization protocols in that yellow book. You can look it up. And they can go anywhere from actually desensitizing somebody in the same day, and it's just very dilute aliquots of trimethoprim sulfa building your way up, to doing it over about a week period. And, you know, before we actually had effective antiretrovirals, this used to be really a big topic of something that we would do in the clinic, because we had so many patients that we wanted to prophylax. They'd have low CD4 counts, and we want to prophylax them. So again, the key things for prophylaxis is, you know, if there's numbers that you want to remember with HIV patients and prophylaxis, less than 200 is one of the key ones, and that's where we want to prophylax against pneumocystis. And so their trimethoprim sulfa, if they don't tolerate trimethoprim sulfa, then the alternatives are dapsone or Mepron. Dapsone is a sulfone. You can still have rashes to dapsone too. Again, G6PD should be checked before using dapsone. But it's otherwise relatively well tolerated. Even if patients that have a trimethoprim sulfa rash can sometimes tolerate dapsone. So it doesn't mean that the two are mutually exclusive. And then etoveqon we usually go with third. You know, the one thing about it we don't think too much about is the cost of these. Trimethoprim sulfa and dapsone are really cheap. You know, it's like a month's supply is $10 or less. Mepron, a tub of quinine, is expensive. Mepron by itself, I think for a week, for 3 weeks worth, is something like $500+. So, you know, if we can use effective, cheaper drugs, we try to. One of the things that's nice about trimethoprim sulfa is that it will prophylax against also toxo, and also will it does have some effect on decreasing bacterial infections as well. So it's got some actual extra properties that we can take advantage of. Dapsone is pretty much purely PCP prophylaxis. Mepron actually has some anti-toxo activity as well. So it may be helpful, you know, if you think about, you know, am I getting more benefit from than just PCP prophylaxis from it? Again, less than 200 is important for as the parameter for pneumocystis prophylaxis. That docs will say if you see oral thrush, you should also be prophylaxing that patient against pneumocystis as well. Secondary prophylaxis, so this is somebody who's had PCP and then it's coming back in. Chronic maintenance therapy with trimethoprim sulfa or equivalent until you get reconstitution of the CD4 counts above 200. And I would say on the safe side, you want to see CD4 counts above 200 for at least 6 months with viral load suppression. And that's somebody then you could start talking about taking them off of their PCP prophylaxis. I would say if you're not seeing that kind of response, it's probably premature to then start taking off prophylaxis. Okay, are we good? And this just goes over the different, I mean, it's exactly what I just told you. It's dapsone, it's metoprolol, and it's trimethoprim sulfa as the regimens. There's all different regimens for trimethoprim sulfa for prophylaxis, everything from double-strength QD, double-strength 3 times a week, single-strength QD. All of them are effective. You know, maybe there's marginal, you know, better effect with one versus the other, but, you know, almost any of those regimens as prophylaxis is pretty effective in terms of preventing PCP pneumonia. Okay, so toxo. So about 15% of folks in the U.S. and 50 to 75% of folks in European countries are exposed to toxo. The greatest risk is when the CD4 count is less than 50. But if someone comes in, you know, with, you know, toxo lesions and CD4 count less than 200, you know, don't rule it out because I just told you it's less than 50. I mean, less than 200, I would say, still you can see toxo between 50 and 200. It's rare if the count's above 200. I don't think I've ever seen anybody with toxoplasma with CD4 greater than 200. Incidence with patients who are seronegative for toxo is extremely low, but not zero. It's about 5% of the patients will actually be seronegative, toxo IgG negative, but still have toxo if we did a brain biopsy. So it's not, it doesn't rule it out if your IgG is negative. So it's less likely, but not zero. Toxo, how does it present? Focal encephalitis with headache, confusion, motor weakness, and fever. Common thing with toxo, you know, what's our differential when we have somebody coming in with a brain lesion with AIDS? Lymphoma and toxo, right? Those are our two big things. Crypto? No. Cryptococcal meningitis, you're not going to see big brain lesions. So, classic about toxo, though, is it's single, solitary, or multiple? Yeah, it's usually multiple. Though we do have seen solitary. When I was on service in whatever September, we had somebody with a solitary lesion. So you can see solitary lesions and still be toxo. Mental status change, much more common with toxo. Although with again, there's a lot of overlap between these two. But with lymphoma, often patients present with seizure. Toxo, you'll see mental status changes. You know, the family will tell you they've been acting really strangely at home. You know, like hearing things, bizarre behaviors, whatever. CT scan of the brain will typically show multiple lesions, edema, single lesions occasionally on the CT scan. Most of the patients actually are toxo IgG. Detection of toxo by PCR and CSF has been disappointing. Depends, you know, which lab again. Specificity is high, but sensitivity is low. The differential we talked about, CNS lymphoma, tuberculomas, fungal infection, Chagas, we don't see that. Bacterial abscess, PML, neurocystic sarcosis. Someone comes in with toxo, we send off the IgG, but really what we're doing actually is we go ahead, you know, and we don't know exactly, is it lymphoma, is it toxo, and we forge ahead with actually toxotherapy. So what do we use for toxotherapy? Anybody want to? What's our first line that we're going to use? Disulfidiazine and pyrimethamine, right. And we have to give with that what? We have to give a leucovorin, right? We have to give a rescue for it. Yeah, CD4 less than 100 is the common presentation for toxo. Baxdrostat is a very effective agent against toxo prophylaxis. This is just prophylaxis. Treatment. Pyrimethamine plus clindamycin is alternative therapies for toxo. So if someone doesn't tolerate sulfadiazine because of rash, then we'll use clindamycin. Adjunctive steroids if we see a lot of edema, right? And anticonvulsant should not be administered as prophylactics to all patients. And these are the regimens here. Brain biopsy should be strongly considered for patients who fail to respond. So when we say that, what we mean is you started them on toxo treatment, and how over what time should you start seeing a response? When do we usually, we have them, we've admitted them, they have multiple lesions, we start them toxo therapy, when do we do imaging again? When do we, when to our next time? About 2 weeks, we should see some, we'll do it again, we should see some interval improvement, hopefully the patient's had clinical improvement. If we're not seeing interval improvement by 2 weeks, then we gotta wonder if it's really toxo or not. Okay? So we should see interval improvement. If we're not, then we start to talk about brain biopsy, which is easier said than done. It's pretty hard to get a brain biopsy done here. I think Cynthia, you were on service at, and there was a patient that arrives on me, and they started to respond, and so they really didn't want to do a brain biopsy. But he was in the hospital for like 3 months. Yeah, he's still there. So this just takes you through the algorithm. Positive patient presents, CT scan, brain mass lesion. Toxo IgG negative doesn't rule it out. Toxo IgG positive, consistent with. Anti-toxo therapy start, you consider the other parts of differential. These are hard to see, but here's a lesion, multiple lesions, right? Ring enhancing, edema. You see all the edema. Pyrimethamine sulfa is the main choice, and pyrimethamine and clinda is the backup. Discontinuation therapy, if the CD4 counts are greater than 200 for more than 6 months, and viral load suppression. No one to say, oh, they're unstable in terms of their antiretrovirals, I'm going to stop their toxo treatment. I would keep them on until they actually show that they're clinically doing, not even clinically, that they're actually suppressed and above 200 for 6 months, taking their meds. Disseminated MAC. So when do we prophylax for MAC? Has anybody seen MAC here? We used to see lots of it. You seen it? Yeah, we used to see lots of it. It's almost like, kind of for me, like stuff that I saw every day, and you guys don't see as much of it anymore. But MAC, you know, has MAC present. High fevers, patients wasting, they dropped lots of weight, diarrhea, anemia. These are the kind of things you see. How do we diagnose MAC? Blood cultures, right. How about sputum? What?
We are kind of low.
Yeah. So if we see sputum showing MAC, we don't act on it. It's usually a harbinger that that patient is at risk for MAC, though. That patient doesn't get antiretrovirals and continues to progress, it's a high risk of those patients that do have sputum with MAC are actually developing MAC. So CD4 count less than 50, so you don't see MAC really in patients that have higher CD4 counts. So less than 50 is actually where we start MAC prophylaxis. What do we use for prophylaxis? What's that? Azithromycin. And as alternative, they don't tolerate azithro, or so the older literature will show you actually even using stuff like rifabutin, but it's probably not as effective as azithro. And the nice thing about azithro is we can dose it once a week. But Bioxin clarithro is probably a little more effective than azithro, but you have to dose it twice a day. Now, always the problem with all the macrolides is that while they're used for prophylaxis, they were also the first line of treatment. You know, so when we treat somebody for MAC, we're using a macrolide, usually with ethambutol. And so in the rare cases where it's happened, where someone developed resistance, you know, they were on the prophylaxis, maybe, you know, they didn't improve, and they get macrolide resistance with MAC. And so then we have a big problem in terms of treating them. Now, the one thing that's good is that we do have effective antiretrovirals, so we don't see nearly as much of this as we used to, but this was a huge problem before, is dealing with OIs like PCP, Toxo, and MAC in terms of, and you know, patients just dwindling over time, and how to actually treat them and control the OIs was a real big problem for us. So there's a lot of things that we saw then that we don't see now, so,
which is good.
You were saying, and exactly right, so MAC is everywhere around us. It's in the water, it's in the soil, so we're constantly surrounded by MAC. So just seeing in the sputum, we wouldn't act on treating it. It has to be either blood or a solid organ. So if I did a liver biopsy and I see MAC in there, I do a lymph node biopsy, I see MAC in there, I see blood culture with MAC, that's where I'm going to actually then treat the person for MAC. Mode of transmission, inhalation, ingestion, or inoculation via respiratory GI tract. There's no special precautions we tell patients to do, though, to avoid MAC. We're probably, again, it's ubiquitous and we're constantly exposed to it. The overall incidence rate is about 2 cases per 100 person years for patients who have these low CD4 counts, so, you know, less than 100. But we really don't see MAC until less than 50, disseminated MAC. Without ARVs, you can see disseminated multi-organ MAC. And that's in, I remember reading that for patients presenting with MAC, there's a huge burden of the organism replacing enormous parts of their solid organs with just organism, where it's almost like 40% of their body weight is actually the MAC organisms themselves. So, you know, the patient's wasted, and again, you guys don't see much of this anymore, but you get heavy bone marrow infiltration, hepatic infiltration, splenic infiltration, and that's what you'll see with MAC. Fever, night sweats, weight loss, fatigue, diarrhea, and abdominal pain. ARVs, when a patient presents with MAC, it's a little different, because now we're not talking about disseminated disease, but a lot of times it's focal disease, and it's not uncommon with someone who has now having iris and has MAC to have focal nodes evolve where they actually may even separate and start to drain. We try not to incise or drain those ourselves. We usually tell them put warm compresses on it. It'll drain maybe sometimes for a couple of months, but we try not to actually use instruments, because then you can form a fistulous tract. So a lot of times, you know, just as the CD4 continues to improve, they'll start to actually stop draining and heal. You can see that with ARVs, you can see everything from lymphadenitis to pneumonitis, pericarditis, osteo, skin or soft tissue abscesses, general ulcers, or CNS infection.
Would you say that on the immune part, that means the immune reconstitution syndrome?
Exactly. You know, so if you looked at the immune reconstitution syndrome, what it really means is that these are all occult OIs. We study them in the heart. And usually, you know, who gets iris? It's the patients with C4s less than 200, and they were harboring basically these occult OIs that we hadn't, you know, get diagnosed, and now they're reconstituted, and we're seeing actually focal, intense, you know, responses to them. And MAC is one of the more common ones if someone's going to have any kind of response. So anemia, increased ALK-FOS, hepatomegaly, splenomegaly, lymphadenopathy. So these are the common things that you'll see for disseminated MAC. Iris, lymphadenitis, absent mycobacteriuremia. So you won't see, you know, disseminated MAC when you have MAC diagnosis we talked about. These are the organisms. I know it's hard to see in the back, but you can see you just have this heavy infiltration of AFB. And here's a good picture of actually a MAC cervical lymphadenitis. So you see this, it's draining and will continue to drain for a couple of months. And then, you know, you just tell them warm compresses, and then actually it actually starts to resolve. CD4 count less than 50 is where you're going to do actually prophylaxis against MAC. I told you how to prophylax against it. We already talked about all this stuff. Treatment is going to be azithro or clarithro with ethambutol. That's going to be the keys to actually MAC treatment. Patients who are started on treatment, I would start them on the HARP pretty quick. So usually within a couple of weeks, you want them on HARP. Because again, the most effective treatment for MAC is going to be improvement in their CD4. And I'm going to stop here. Questions you guys have? Things you want to go over?
Good question. If your patient is on PCP for 5 days, what are the chances that he develops